Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the following restaurants for supporting No Goat Left Behind, Ottomanelli & Sons, and Salamuria Rossi. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Welcome to another episode of Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Arway. We're here at Roberta's, as usual. It's a gorgeous Indian summer Monday in the middle of October. That's always nice. A little backlash of summer. My vegetables are actually really dry this morning, and I actually watered them for the first time in a while. But they're still kicking. So today's guest, I'm really excited because she's about to come out with a book this weekend called An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace. And what exactly does that mean? I thought I'd read a little passage from the first page of the book. I really dug deep to get this quote. Okay. But this is not a cookbook or a memoir or a story about one person or one thing. It is a book about eating affordably, responsibly, and well, because doing so relies on cooking. It is mostly about that. Cooking is both simpler and more necessary than we imagine. It has in recent years come to seem a complication to juggle against other complications instead of what it can be, a clear path through them. Let me go on. If we are to weed today through all the advice for how to eat better and choose what we ourselves feel most able and like best to do, we must regain our faith that cooking can be advantageous, something that helps eating well makes sense. Sorry.
It's the Indian summer.
It's the Indian summer. So that is by Tamar Adler. Thanks so much for being here.
Of course.
That was really gorgeous. And this book, it's actually filled with prose as well as recipes. It's not a cookbook. It's, I don't know, what do you call it?
It's cross-genre, I think.
It's cross-genre.
I mean, that's not what I call it. I think it is, I think it's narrative and instructional. And its point is to kind of awaken people and guide them through the kitchen as opposed to directing them. I feel like those are really different things. Those are actually, I mean, they seem similar, but those are really different energies, right? One is kind of ordering people and one is giving them a hand.
Right.
And sort of staying with them through the process of thinking about cooking and then serving and eating.
Yeah. I can definitely see that in your recipes too, because I know what you mean by like the didactic tone that sometimes cookbooks can have. Like looking through old cookbooks, it's like you must rinse this or something, or I mean, I guess you should rinse everything, but you know, you must peel this tomato, I don't know. And your recipes are kind of it's more relaxed and it's just kind of cozy.
Well, I think that you know, one of the things that I am trying to counteract in the writing of this book and getting this book out there is the sense that we have that cooking is staccato and recipes are staccato. And I mentioned this in the introduction, but I think it, I mean, I could have gone on about it for a chapter because recipes make it seem like you're supposed to start with absolutely nothing and cut a cup of something.
Or buy all this stuff.
Buy all this stuff. Exactly. Start at the very beginning and then the meal stops. You know, the preparation stops once you've cooked it, and the meal stops once you stand up from the table. And the reason for the title of the book, which is An Everlasting Meal, and the reason that the recipes read differently is that I wanted to imbue all of the food preparation and all of the food presentation in the book with a sense of continuity that I think is what makes cooking make sense.
Oh, that's so true. You know what? A lot of people ask me when I was doing this 2 years of not eating out, they're like, well, how did you do that? And my most frequent response was like, if you just cook a little more often, and I use this term, it has a domino effect, which is not as beautiful and graceful as...
No, it is. I think I wrote topple like dominoes, that meals have to topple like dominoes into one another.
I was trying to say, like, you're going to have stuff in your fridge and stuff like that.
Yeah. It takes on, you know, a wave-like quality, a tide-like quality, mm-hmm. I think. You know, things sort of get pushed into one meal, and then you eat a lot of it, and some gets drawn back to shore. And then when the wave goes out again...
See, that is so poetic. It's more... and I think domino effect, people maybe have been like intimidated. Like,
well,
I don't know.
A little cold worry, but...
I don't want to step into that jungle. But you make it seem really fun.
Thank you.
And graceful. So, and when did you have this, like, was it like a lightning bulb thing? Like, people aren't cooking. What?
This book is inspired by How to Cook a Wolf by M.F.K. Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always, since I read that book, wanted to refresh its messages because they're just as relevant. It was written in 1942.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, similarly written
by M.F.K. Fisher.
By M.F.K. Fisher, who's, you know, the doyen of food writing, or literary food writing.
Yeah.
And in 1942, there were food shortages and food rationing. And there was, like... Right, like there is right now, a lot of dogma around eating, and people felt like it was hard to eat well, and it was hard to cook. And what that book did was, instead of telling people to tighten their belts and make do, it offered a helping hand back to the kitchen, and then really showed how pleasure could be fostered there through cooking.
And pleasure, and cheerfulness, because how to cook a wolf, that's kind of tongue-in-cheek. I mean, she wasn't trying to tell anybody.
No, but a wolf, you know, what a wolf was the wolf of hunger. A wolf is a sort of poetic and now antiquated term for being hungry. And so she was saying, you know, the wolf of hunger is scratching at our doors, and we're going to cook it instead of letting it in. And I have always wanted to make those messages relevant. And as eating well has come to seem more important and more difficult, it's also the instructions about how to, or directions and recommendations for how to, have become as dogmatic as they were then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's making people feel stressed.
Do you think that there's a certain atmosphere right now that people would possibly need this reminder, similar to when MFK Fisher was writing and she felt people needed to know this? Is there some similarities?
I mean, I think that the zeitgeist now is probably even more receptive to these messages than it was then.
Yeah.
Because now, I mean, as you know, you're working on the same stuff. There is an incredible desire to get into our kitchens. And the problem is that we don't have the tools that we need to make that return make sense to us. So we're kind of turning to our kitchens, and instead of seeing welcoming environments, we're finding hostile ones because we don't really know what to do when we get there. And I think that, you know, that a direct correlation between her situation and ours is that the available resources for what to do in our kitchens are not helpful.
Okay.
So I wanted to provide something that was actually helpful based on what people feel able to do and what they have, that also isn't sort of in the small and rather intense category of 30 minutes or less, 15 ingredients for 15 meals, 20 ways to use a can of beans. I mean, you know, it's just not, it doesn't need to be that sort of grim.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, I find that also neurotic. And it doesn't need to be. So, you know, I think people in 1942, we're feeling a really great neurotic pressure.
Yeah,
and
this,
people
so this
are now.
Is a wartime situation, and this is a big national concern. And right now, it almost seems, you know, there's people protesting because they're unemployed. The last few weeks, the depression, it's sort of it's a recession.
It is really similar. I mean, you know, unemployment, as we know, is at 9.1%. The article came out today saying that incomes dropped between the end of the recession and this past June by 6.7%. And that's supposed to be after the recession. I mean, we are at different kinds of war on different fronts.
So what do you think happened in the time between? Did we just get fat and happy with spending, or I don't know?
No, I mean, there's really, you know, there are different and great analyses of it. But part of what happened was that, you know, convenience food showed up and relieved what had been an enormous burden on women.
Mm.
And that was, you know, and I think that was welcomed. There's also, you know, the fact that industrially produced food made it, made food less expensive,
mm-hmm.
and made it a lot easier for food companies to do, you know, mass production of very cheap stuff. And essentially it became like inexpensive convenience food became widely available.
Yeah, and marketing too, because who has commercials for apples? I guess they do now, but it's not quite the same extent as Cheerios.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, people really pushed women toward convenience food.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, the home economics movement was incredibly powerful. And that's not what we think of as like home ec classes. It's the sense that complete efficiency and
I don't remember learning that.
Well, you know, it's there's a great book by Laura Shapiro that I don't remember the name of now, but that traces the kind of the removal of the means of production from the hands
school.
Of housewives.
Oh, okay.
No. And that, you know, it really was this whole movement of people who were saying that the goal was to, you know, eventually the goal was to not have any food production at home, to have food production outside of the house, and have centralized sources where, you know, like hubs where people would come and pick up already made food, and the kitchen would be this sort of clean, unsullied room domain that, you know, that
sounds
was
kind of freaky.
Yeah, it sounds. And the funny thing is that it's not that dissimilar from what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think like it kind of worked.
Or no kitchens in some instances.
Yeah,
especially in the city. Well, how did you start? You know, you were inspired by the book and the messages, but you've been a cook as well. Correct?
Yeah. I think it took me a long time to feel like I knew how to breathe new life into her messages.
Right.
It
so took learning the skills. And,
I mean, I grew up cooking, but I think it took a lot of on-the-ground experience for me to be able to say very precisely, this is what you need. You know, I always had a sense of it, but I think putting it on paper would have been hard for me. I would have had to say, literally, come into my kitchen with me. And what I try to do in this book is say, you know, kind of metaphorically come into my kitchen with me and then show people what it is like in my kitchen. And that took time spent in kitchens. And I've always loved, I mean, I felt pulled toward professional cooking.
And you were a cook at Chez Panisse for how many years?
No? I was only at Chez Panisse for about a year and a half.
Okay.
And then got called back in sometimes.
Uh-huh.
I've always said that Chez Panisse is a little bit like the CIA. You know,
you're CIA?
Yeah, you're always on call.
Okay.
You never get out. Maybe it's not the CIA, but it's like being a spy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does that still happen now?
No, but you still get phone calls when when Alice is in town and there's some event that has to happen on the East Coast. There are cells of Chez Panisse alumni everywhere who, you know, get a call like you see in the movies, and then you get called to service.
This sounds pretty interesting. So you're like branded for life.
Yes, totally.
As a part of this cult.
Yes, family.
That's really neat.
But yeah, I was at Chez Panisse for I guess about a year and a half. And before that, I had been the chef of a restaurant that I opened with friends in Georgia.
Okay.
And that also played a large role in the writing of this book, because we felt there, as inexperienced restaurant owners, a lot of the pressures that people feel when they're trying to eat sustainably on a shoestring budget. Mm. Now, because we were a restaurant on a shoestring budget, trying to eat locally and sustainably. And it was hard. And we had to come up with a lot of the strategies that I think are peasant cooking strategies and the strategies in the book.
Yeah, I hear this so much from like chefs and restaurants. It's like they know how to use leftovers and make it economical. And it's so funny that, you know, people don't realize they can do the same at home, you know. And
well, I mean, it's what you do.
And it's what you have to do to make anything viable, right? Yeah. Run a restaurant and it looks great in the end. You would never guess, you know.
I mean, chicken stock, as you know, is the best example of it. No restaurant. I mean, a few restaurants will use just water for their soups, and they can also be delicious. But, you know, the finest restaurant in the world relies on chicken stock, which is made from what we consider garbage, right?
Compost.
Yeah, scraps.
One bucket for compost, one bucket for, well, actually, it could be the same thing. Well, chicken stock.
Yeah, but like instead of your garbage, you know, people, we've already made it to the place where people think instead of my garbage, I could put stuff in my compost for my garden. But what I'm saying in this book is, okay, instead of putting stuff in your compost for your garden,
eat it.
Put stuff in your chicken stock pot. Yeah, eat it.
Yeah. Very cool. Simpler. All right. Well, so what are you hoping that, what do you think is like the biggest takeaway from reading instead of just enjoying it? Would that be what we just said or?
Well, I think that it's something more concrete, which is that what the missing piece in the conversation about how to eat better is, in order to follow the recommendations to eat food and mostly plants and food that only
are, like a pollen there.
Yeah, you know, which is some of the best advice out there. But Alice Waters' advice is also great, and Eric Schlosser's, and all of the people who've said, you know, this is the kind of food we should be buying, whole food, whole ingredients, locally grown food, that seems hard for us because we lack the skills that we need for it to seem possible, for
and
it to seem plausible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that one of the best ways of putting it is Michael Pollan says that we should only buy food our grandmothers or great grandmothers would recognize. Well, in order for that to make sense, we need sort of the set of lenses with which our grandmothers and great grandmothers assessed the food around them. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm providing in this book is that set of lenses. And once we have it, I think that following that advice is actually possible.
Well, that is very inspiring, and I hope that a lot of people will take that to heart. And sometimes it starts with just learning one recipe, and then you like, oh, well, that turned out really good, like this bread here or something. So hopefully more domino effects
will take
place.
Tides and dominoes.
So we're going to have a little musical break, and I know you picked out a song. I think I know why now.
Right.
Georgia on Your Mind. So we'll be right back.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still in
all right. right. Nice choice, Tamar.
Thank you.
We're back on Let's Eat In with Tamar Adler, the author of the upcoming An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace. And that was her musical choice. So just want to mention also that this book is being released on the 18th, really soon. And to celebrate that, Tamar's going to have a book reading, a lively book reading at Book Court in Brooklyn, where herself and Francine Stevens, the founder, co-owner of Franny's in Brooklyn, will have a conversation about cooking gracefully, and they'll have some food to share, some snacks prepared by tomorrow, and some other alumni from Chez Panisse, or cult member, should I say?
Yes, cult, one former cult member, I guess current cult member, as per what I said earlier, and two of my apprentices from the Edible Schoolyard in Brooklyn this summer. So it will be a cross-coastal.
You were in the Edible Brooklyn this summer?
Yeah, I was. I was actually their first culinary teacher. We started a culinary program this summer.
Okay.
It's at PS 216.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Mm.
Were you involved with the Edible Schoolyard back in Berkeley?
I wasn't. I mean, you know, I was cooking.
Yeah. Stopped
from
there.
Full time. Actually, it doesn't, you know, all of the food that comes from there goes to the school, but you know, there's a very close relationship between the Edible Schoolyard at Martin Luther King and Chez Panisse, because it was started by the Chez Panisse Foundation and funded by the Chez Panisse Foundation. You know, and the one, the Edible Schoolyard in Gravesend at PS 216 is sort of affiliated in terms of ethos, and it's sort of its genesis in the same, in the foundation and in the same, you know, the same people. But this is the first one that I worked at, and my apprentices have been looking forward to the release of this
book. Oh, that's great.
Book, so.
Were your apprentices like students or?
No, one of them was a Montessori teacher.
Okay.
Who just moved to New York, and one is a former line cook, and both of them are really excited about edible education.
Yeah.
All summer we did a very good job of making food everlastingly. We used stuff from the garden, and we made a lot of toasts, which are a big part of the book. You know, we didn't have an oven.
Things on top of bread.
Yeah, things on top of bread. So that's what we're also doing at the book launch party. Really amazing things.
You know what? I did something like that at my book launch party at Word Bookstore. I put roasted beets on top of bread and something. I think it was a reduction of vinegar, balsamic, and
goat cheese. You know, trenchants were bread plates. In the Middle Ages, bread, bread used to be used as plates.
Trenchants? What?
Yeah.
What's that?
It's a bread plate.
Oh, okay. Whoa.
So we're doing bread plates with really delicious things on them.
Nice. Is it from the edible garden that you're working at?
No, we're doing, actually, my friend at Bark Hot Dogs is contributing all of the vegetables.
Nice.
And they're just from, you know, they'll be from the green market.
Their folks, okay.
And, and it will be really amazing, you know, kale.
That sounds like a great, like, community work, teamwork right here.
Yes.
Just, Franny Stevens and...
Yeah, well, it's you know, we have a great food community in Brooklyn, and everybody has definitely rallied together around this book, which is so great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really is like the whole family of the Franny's. It's not un-Chez Panisse. There's a branching family that's
there. Definitely
know,
is. Yeah. Maybe a cult to come. We'll see.
Yeah, CTC, cult to come.
And you know, I spent a little time in San Fran recently, and I came back. You know, and you've been there for a while. So, what do you think are like some of the differences, or are there in the food communities?
We are very we're trend based in a way that
New York is.
Yeah, I think New York is still sees food in terms of fashion in a way that the Bay Area doesn't.
Yeah.
And I think right now we're in a little bit of danger of all of the really good developments of the last little while, which, you know, are mostly based in Brooklyn, being kind of branded as a trend, which puts them at risk of becoming untrendy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would be a shame, because we have an incredible burgeoning artisanal community here, and we have gardens on a ton of rooftops with their produce being served by
over our heads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so good. And, you know, that is a great similarity, that the difference is that we have a really high metabolism for mm-hmm. trends here, and the Bay Area doesn't have that. There's a, there's a rootedness to all of this stuff. And I hope it takes root.
Well, I hope that home cooking doesn't become overly trendy and then blow out or something. Yeah. I don't really see that happening.
I mean, the funny thing about this terrible economy is that it does actually create the perfect environment for returning to our kitchens, because not having a job does mean a little bit more time. And I don't think that cooking well takes more time, but I think settling into the idea of taking back sort of the means of production of our food might take a little bit of time. And we have that. And, you know, it is also just literally true that we need to find a way to eat both more healthfully mm-hmm. and more affordably. And that's what cooking, especially grounded peasant cooking, allows. And the economy, unfortunately, isn't getting better. But, you know, for the cause of cooking, it's not a terrible thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking, you know, I'm very curious to see what'll happen. And your book is definitely a great contribution to this effort. Speaking of cooking, I'm getting really hungry now thinking about...
Yes.
Because I've actually had the pleasure of tasting some of Tamara's food before, and it's really astounding. So
I forgot that you... Yeah, you did.
It was really amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
What is your perfect date meal?
You know, this is really embarrassing, but probably a version of the meal that you had is my perfect
that squid
meal for
stew
everything.
Was amazing. And the beans. And
doesn't that sound very date-like to you?
No,
squid
stew
and beans.
Well, you describe it.
And don't forget the garlic mayonnaise.
Oh, yeah.
That was based on a grand aioli, which is a Provençal meal that sounds very complicated.
Grand aioli?
Yeah.
Big aioli.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, aioli refers both to the sauce and mm-hmm. to the ritual meal surrounding it.
I did not know that.
It's great. You know, it's sort of like, I was going to say spaghettata, which is, you know, a big spaghetti sort of festival.
That sounds pretty romantic.
Spaghettata. It's like Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah.
You know, you have one big bowl of spaghetti. And aioli is garlic mayonnaise. But in the sort of spring and summer, in the spring and summer, it's a traditional meal in Provence. And the way it is created is everybody makes aioli mm-hmm. by pounding up garlic and making a mayonnaise, very simple, of olive oil and egg yolk. And then a ton of vegetables and eggs, which, you know, only come back into season in the spring
mm-hmm.
when
mm-hmm.
chickens start laying, are very simply prepared or served raw. And the way the meal works is that all of those simply prepared vegetables and eggs are dipped into the mayonnaise and you drink rosé. And it's incredibly simple, but also incredibly romantic and kind of lusty and garlicky and amazing. And the meal that you ate of mine was a petite aioli. You can have a petite aioli and a grand aioli and an aioli monstre.
Okay.
And a petite one is just vegetables uh-huh. and a grand one will have some beans and some squid.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Or salt.
So was I supposed to dip the squid into the aioli?
I dipped everything in.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
I probably didn't make it clear. But yeah. And the great thing is also the ratio of mayonnaise to other ingredients that you get to eat in an aioli of any size, because you can eat an enormous amount of garlic mayonnaise when the rest of the meal is, you know, boiled potatoes and boiled eggs and, you know, some pieces of raw vegetable and squid. And everything just gets dipped.
So it's just like
aioli.
Dipping and dipping.
Yeah.
That's pretty
the everlasting dip. Garlic mayonnaise.
That's a really neat date meal concept. I'll have to try that out.
Do. It's incredibly
just
easy to make.
And then feed your partner.
Yeah. And they're
mayonnaise.
Garlicky mayonnaise.
Garlicky mayonnaise. Dribbling down my chin.
Yeah. All kinds of entendres. There's French involved, which is romantic.
Yes, anything French, just done. We did it. Right, so what is your favorite recipe in the book, if you could choose one? I know it depends on what you have during that day and how much time you have and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could start from scratch and just pick anything, what is the best?
In the first chapter, there's a recipe that isn't in recipe form. There are many like that in the book, but in the very first chapter, there is a sort of long narrative that leaves you with a boiled chicken and chicken stock. Mm. And I think that's one of the most important and wonderful things that we can make. Boiled chicken has fallen far out of fashion, but that's because we're not super great at boiling right now. And actually, boiling is a far underrated technique. And what I do in that chapter is explain to people how to salt a whole chicken.
Okay.
And how to put it in a pot and how much water and vegetable scraps to put in and the level of boil that is best at, in the pot.
And how long?
Yeah. And okay. I mean, and I think that everybody that has read the book has come back at me immediately with saying, I can't believe that a boiled chicken is so great. And that I taught a bunch of mothers how to do what I did in that chapter to see if it would take.
Yeah.
And have gotten emails from all of them saying, I boil a chicken every week.
Oh.
And it really sets me off, to a great start because I have that night's meal and the next day's lunch and I use the chicken stock. And I also taught them how to make risotto with the chicken stock.
Yeah.
And they really started feeling like they were having that domino effect experience. And I think that's just one of the best things that we can do. And I boil a chicken, if not every week, every 2 weeks, and feel like it's like the tidal energy that I was talking about.
How to boil a chicken.
How to boil a chicken.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to try that now that it's getting, well, hopefully it'll get cold soon.
Right.
We'll see.
It will. As soon as you get used to the heat.
All right. I'm going to definitely try that and try more of your recipes in here. And unfortunately, I can't make it to the book signing party, but it does sound pretty awesome next Monday at Book
Tuesday,
Court.
Tuesday
the 18th at Book Court.
Delicious.
Check it out.
Rosé.
Open to the public. Thanks so much, Tamara. That was really
fun.
And thanks to Jack and everyone at Heritage. We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event. The following message has been brought to you by Taste Brooklyn. Our city's finest chefs partner with farmers and local vineyards next to the Green Market for an extraordinary outdoor culinary festival. Try exquisite delicacies using locally grown seasonal delights on the plaza outside Brooklyn's Borough Hall. Top chefs and artisans will offer sumptuous fare paired with premium wines, all to empower our neediest children to get healthy. The mighty FDNY and DSNY harbor their own culinary masters in uniform. They will cook off against the pros. Sample delicious cuisine without stressing over a reservation while supporting a worthy cause. Taste Brooklyn's Field to Fork Outdoor Culinary Festival, Saturday, October 15th, 2011, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Learn more and buy tickets at tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. That's TASTESOF Brooklyn.blogspot.com. This is a public service announcement from Sea to Table and Slow Food NYC.
On October 11th, sustainable seafood distributor Sea to Table will join Slow Food New York City to host an event celebrating the bounty of local New York seafood. The event, Slow You, Sustainable Sashimi, will feature a tasting of four fish species from local Montauk waters. The event will take place on Tuesday, October 11th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Institute of Culinary Education, 50 West 23rd Street in Manhattan. Tickets are $25 for Slow Food members, $35 for non-members. Visit slowfoodnyc.org for more information about this event and how to get tickets.